Okay, good morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this AppV session, Implementing AppV5, Lessons Learned from a Production Rollout. Nice turn up, given that AppV is a relatively small product within the Microsoft portfolio. My name is Men van der Plas. I come from the Netherlands. I work for a company called Login Consultants. You can find me on Twitter, and I do some blogging. And today I'm going to talk to you about implementing AppV5 and some of the stuff that I've done at production customers. Let me start by raising hands. How many of you are experienced with AppV4.6? Okay, so most of you. So just to give you a heads up, this will be a level 300 session. So I will not cover some of the basics of application virtualization and AppV4.6, and we'll focus primarily on AppV5. So some familiarity with the AppV, you know, technical concepts are required for this session. So what are my goals for this session for you guys? I want to give you an overview of some of the changes that have occurred in AppV5, and there are quite a lot. How many of you have been to other AppV5 sessions this week? Okay, not too many, 20%. I will cover some of those basic concepts, and I think the most technical, interesting ones to show you. I will walk you through the design process that I did for this particular customer, and you know it's very, you know, it's specific for this customer, but there are some things that you can, you know, get out of that. And I will share with you some of the implementation pitfalls and gotchas that we've ran into. So if I go to the changes in AppV5, how many of you have played around with it in lab environments, production environments, anybody? Some of you already in production environments? Okay, pretty cool. So here's a small, you know, sum up of some of the changes that have occurred in AppV5. We lost the Q drive as a drive letter. There's still some virtualization and isolation going on. We don't have a 4 GB package limit anymore. Our user settings that were traditionally saved in AppV4 in, you know, proprietary.pkg files are now open and exposed to us in the registry and in the file system, making it more, you know, understandable what ends up in there. We have now rich PowerShell command line scripting. I will do a lot of PowerShell in the first session. How many are familiar with PowerShell? Okay, most of you are. Good. I wasn't actually before Microsoft decided to put PowerShell into AppV5, so I'm no PowerShell guru at all. But I, you know, you can teach yourself some basic stuff. So if you're not familiar with PowerShell and you will be supporting Microsoft AppV5, make sure that you will cover that. And we have some web-based management for the management infrastructure. And this is just a small list of the changes that have occurred in AppV5. It's a very extensive and very new release. So the last four ones I want to share with you a little bit more in depth, because I think that's where the most of the innovative changes have occurred in AppV5. So let's start by showing you some of the basic AppV5 stuff. So this is a normal Windows 7 workstation. I have an application here that runs in AppV5. So nothing new here, right? It's still virtualization. I can go down to, for example, C, program files, common files. I can see an Adobe folder in this virtualized environment. But if I browse down to the real operating system data, I can see that the Adobe folder doesn't occur on the actual file system. So it's still isolation, and AppV still, you know, keeps that information away from the operating system and away from being touched at the operating system. But the interesting part is that the client interface is more open. Now, on this machine, I do have a Q drive. It's because I also have the 4.6 client on here, as you can see here. But that's not where AppV stores its stuff. It stores it in open structures. So in program data, AppV, for example, I go down to a specific package, version GUID and package GUID. I can just browse down to it. I can go down into the actual installation files, and I can run the executable from there. So it's much more open now. You can actually browse down to those folders. And the same goes for, you know, the Delta files that are stored in the registry and in the file system. You can just browse down to it. So that's pretty powerful. So talking about those more advanced changes, some of the things that we've run into, at least I've run into with customers, is the amount of exposure that is. I mean, it's a good thing that the applications are isolated, but there was a trade-off, right? Applications could not interact with other applications or with the local operating system. Now, the number of extension points, which is how Microsoft now calls it, has extended. So besides shortcuts and file type associations, URL protocols are now supported. Default, programs are supported. There are a couple of other items here as well. So you can actually expose more information about the application to the system. And to even, make that point even stronger, if you look at, for example, Microsoft Office Click to Run, it's also based on AppV technology. Which means that, Office is one of the programs that has a lot of interaction and interaction with the operating system. So just to give you an idea of how much the support currently is. So this will definitely help, reaching a higher percentage of, virtualized applications in your environments. So another one is new, which is relatively new, because this already existed in what we knew around OSD files in FV4.6. But now it's called deployment and user configuration. And there are actually three locations where the configuration can take place. There's one inside the package that cannot be changed. It's a default, configuration that the application was sequenced with. But the sequencer also spits out two additional files. One is called a deployment configuration XML, and the other is called the user configuration XML. Now, inside these XMLs, we can pretty much do everything we used to do with OSD files. How many of you did any customization with OSD files? Scripting, registry tags, I don't know, those kind of things? Okay. So this is the new location where you want to do that. And it's even extended. For example, not everything is done under the user context. You can actually make changes to the system if you require it. I will demo that shortly. So you have a per-user configuration and a per-machine configuration, and depending on what configuration you want to change, it's in either of those sections. And the hierarchy is from left to right, so the user configuration will always take precedence over any deployment or app manifest configuration that is inside the package. These can be copied out. This is basic XML. You can copy more of them. You can tie different configuration to different user groups and those kind of things. So the next one, which has drastically changed, is connection groups. And connection groups is basically dynamic suite composition version 2. How many of you use dynamic suite composition? Not that many. Okay. So what I always found hard with dynamic suite composition is that it was very hard to manage. You implement it at package level, and after it was executed into your environment, there was no way of tracking which applications were tied to which application. So that has changed in FV5 as well. You now manage it at no longer at package level, but at infrastructure level, or you can even manage it into the client, but no longer inside the package. So the AppV infrastructure can manage it. SCCM, if you use SCCM integration, that can manage it. But you can also do it yourself through scripting. I will show you that in a demo shortly. The big difference between dynamic suite composition and connection groups is also that connection groups have their own identity, which means that if an application A has a specific set of configuration, an application B has a specific set of configuration, if they are joined in a connection group, that connection group will have a third identity, so have a third set of configuration. So that's good. So it's saved apart from the original package. Now, if you join two applications in a connection group, there's a theoretical chance that there might be a conflict. But conflicts can be handled. You can set the order of the applications, and the highest one takes precedence. But you can also, if an application is part of two connection groups, and you launch that specific application, you can tell the FV client which of the two connection groups it should by default run in. So all those conflicts can be handled as well. So the fourth and last one I like very much is, I think, a very innovative change, especially for virtual desktop environments. It's called the Shared Content Store. So in FV4, we are familiar with the read-only shared cache, I think it's called, or the shared-only read cache. Or it was this, you know, read-only file that we had to place onto the network where all the VDIs could point to, so that you don't have that storage impact on each and every VDI. But the problem with having that read-only is management was pretty hard. So you had to change that, you know, you had to copy that read-only file out to a writable PC, update your entire cache file, copy it back onto the network. But it was in use by the you know, users that were actually using those applications. So you had to do all kinds of symbolic linking. It was pretty hard to implement. It was a very technical implementation. I haven't seen any implementations actually with it in production. Now, the shared content store is, you know, from a high level perspective, is trying to, you know, create the same thing. They want to reduce the storage impact if you have 1,000 VDIs and you want to reduce the storage impact because all those VDIs will, you know, share 80-90% maybe of the same applications. But the implementation is totally different. This is something you implement at client level. You just flip a switch, and after that point, the AppV client will, you know, can be managed in just the same way, but the streaming source will always be reside on the streaming server or the network share where your content is from. So it's streamed down on demand, but it's not cached on the machine. So it's dropped after it's used. So while the application is in use, obviously the bits have to be there, but it's not the entire package. It's basically on demand. Now this does, you know, create an additional load on your network, of course, but it does also reduce a lot of storage on your client. And just to give you an idea how much storage that is, this was actually at this customer where we had a package size of 12.1 gigabytes of, I think it was 50 packages or something. So the storage impact on the machine was only 500 megabytes. I mean, you could still argue what's in that 500 megabytes, but this is 95% reduction. So this is a whole lot. So that means that every VDI that we deploy has this storage reduction implemented. And the management is just the same. It receives the updates to the application the same way as maybe your laptop configuration or your desktop configuration or maybe your terminal server configuration that is using AppV within that same infrastructure. You don't have to change anything on the package. You don't have to change anything in your management infrastructure. So this, I think, this is a very important killer feature. So let me demo you some of those, what I think are very innovative changes in the environment. Let me first show you that connection group thing. So I have a couple of applications here, three plugins that are, you know, sequenced with Internet Explorer, and I'm going to add them to the AppV client manually. So this is all PowerShell. The FV client has PowerShell object, server as well, sequencer as well. So it's pretty simple, at least when you become familiar with PowerShell. Add FV client package, point to a path. You can, you know, pipe it to multiple commands, publish it at once, all those kind of things. So I run the applications or implement the applications, and I now have applications that have. So this is, for example, Java. So this Internet Explorer has a Java plugin. Well, we could do that with FV4.6, right? This is the same. But now, so these applications were not, you know, sequenced together in any way. So I'm now going to create that connection group on the fly outside of the package environment. So I'm going to create two connection groups, again, through PowerShell. And I'm going to connect the Flash application package to the Java package, and I'm also going to add the Flash package to the Shockwave package, just to create that conflict that I was telling you about. So I've now created those virtual environments, and if I were to look at, for example, Shockwave, and I select the add-ons, I can see that the Shockwave ActiveX controller is actually joined in the Flash package. So this just proves that these connection groups are tied together. But what if I run the flash package, which is part of two connection groups? And that's where that priority thing comes into play. So I've made the flash package priority zero in, let me see which one I created. I think it's with JRA. Yeah. So the highest wins, so that means that if I start the flash package, which is part of two connection groups, it will start it in the Java runtime environment. Oh, no, not that one. This one runs in the Java virtual environment, of course. Flash, this one. Oh, here you can see it already. So if I start Flash, you know, natively, I can see that it runs in the Java virtual environment. But another cool trick is this is, I have now launched the applications with a very specific shortcut that I created during sequencing. But if you remember that first demo I gave where I could just browse down to the executable and start it, I could do that as well. So even if I have sequenced the application without any shortcut and I have this third-party shortcut management system or user environment management system or even group policy preferences if you want, I can target those runtimes with any application that I'd like. So it's far more extendable now. So you don't have to worry about, oh, I sequence this application package with this Java, but it's the wrong URL, I have to update the package. That's all gone. You can basically start Internet Explorer in any virtual environment that you want. But in this example, I use specifically the shortcut that was in the start menu. But the problem is with plugins is that users will not always run that shortcut, right? So they can start Internet Explorer in any way they want. And there's something cool that Microsoft has created. And they're not very vocal about it, so let me tell you what it is. It's the run virtual key. Run virtual is part of the AppV client registry set. And basically, if I register a process here, and I put a default value of the package ID underscore the version ID in there, the process after that will always run in that virtual environment, no matter how I start it. And that's very interesting for specifically, you know, Internet Explorer plugins. So let me apply this one in the registry. And I'm now starting this Internet Explorer. Now, this Internet Explorer has nothing to do with the application that I've published, right? So this is just, it's just Internet Explorer, right? There's no, you know, flags or anything. So if I run this one, I can see that it now also runs in the virtual environment, always, no matter how I start the virtual environment. So this is pretty powerful. This also works with connection groups. So if I have a set of plugins, this is actually a set of plugins. So you can extend it with Silverlight or, you know, whatever plugins you want. And you can run, you know, Internet Explorer in any way you want, and you can actually apply this. Pretty interesting, right? You think? Okay, next one I want to show you is some of the customization that you still can do in XML files. So we knew OSD scripting. We have the registry tags, we have the script tag, we have, you know, I don't know, terminate children and all those kind of tags inside the OSD files that are now part of these deployment and user configs. So what I did, I copied one of those, I edited it, I threw out the stuff that I don't need, and I implemented two additional things. So in this case, I'm using the registry tag, which is, I mean, it's implemented differently, but it's the same functionality. Registry tag and inject a registry key into the virtual environment, and I run a script. The difference with scripting, though, is that it does require .exe as the path, so it doesn't support, it does still support VBS, but the executable has to be like WScript or CScript or whatever. So there's no inline scripting anymore, like we used to do. So these will get implemented. So if I run this, implement this package, and I run the application, you notice maybe a quick command box because that was the script that was running. But this is the same functionality. So let me check inside the virtual environment. And I'm going to do that by running a registry editor inside the virtual environment. And there's a cool trick with running applications inside the virtual environment as well, which is also not very documented widely. If you're familiar with that before, we could do the SFT trace /exe, and we can run customized commands inside the virtual environment for troubleshooting. How many are familiar with that? Okay, good. So this is a little different. We don't have a launcher object anymore in ABV5 because I can just browse down to the executable and launch it. So what I can do with any particular executable, I can point the ABVVE switch, that's two Vs, after every executable, put the package GUID and version GUID behind it, and that executable will always run in the virtual environment. It's a pretty cool trick. There are some other flags in there as well. So I can run this registry editor inside the virtual environment, and I can see that my registry key got applied in HK local machine, and the other one is somewhere in current user. So that works still the same. Registry keys, those kind of things are still possible in ABV5. But it has extended. And one of the things that I've run into with customers a lot is that sometimes, we like the fact that ABV is virtualized and isolated, right? But sometimes we need some piece of software to be installed prior to that ABV package, some piece of middleware or some driver or those kind of things, the stuff that couldn't be virtualized, right? And if you have like a system like SCCM, you could tie those together. But if you don't, if you only have the full infrastructure or any third-party other deployment solution that couldn't handle that, it was impossible to do, right? But that has changed in ABV5 because if you remember that deployment config XML that I showed you that is new, that can actually support some of that scripting and do it under system privileges. So on this machine, I don't have any specific software installed. It's the ABV client, some of the prereqs that are there. And I'm now going to add and publish an application package that requires a driver. And this is just done through the scripting tag. So if you can, unattendedly install that driver, this can be done. One of the things you have to keep in mind, and it got me a couple of times, is that if you want to do scripting, there's a specific setting in ABV. It's enable package scripts, and you have to set it to 1. Otherwise, these scripts will just not run. It will not give you an error, but they just won't run. So this is a very good thing to just implement if you want to use scripting. If I look at AppRemove programs, didn't it run? Oh, I didn't copy it correctly, I think. Yes, I want this one. What is the work? Oh, sorry. My mistake. Okay, great. That's a connection group. Let me clear out the entire demo. I just want to show you that that can be done. I think I might have used application double or something. All right. It was this one. There you go. No applause needed. So you can see in the bottom, the primer driver did actually install. But the cool thing is, we won't tell the... Are there any SCCM admins in the room? Okay. You close your ears. Because now, you guys weren't afraid of the ABV admins before because these guys couldn't install anything anyway, right? So this is something you have to be aware of, right? So we can do stuff now as well. But if we are good admins... We will also, if the package is removed, remove the software from the machine as well. So it works both ways. So if we're good admins, we will do this. So I'm not saying that this is a particularly like good feature in a way that you should just put all your middleware stuff in script and install it at runtime? Obviously not, because there's no reporting on that or anything. But it's sometimes easy to do it in this way, right? So the last thing I wanted to show you was the shared content store. And there's nothing I actually can show you other than show you that it is enabled on my machine, as you can see here. So I've enabled this application in shared content mode, and after that, I could just do the same stuff that I was used to. Add applications, launch applications, everything works in the same way. The only difference is that it won't actually store the information on the client. And one way to tell it if it didn't store anything is if you were to look inside a package that is currently published. Oh, aren't there any? Oh, there aren't any published. Let me publish one quickly. For example, Adobe Reader. You can see that the application, the WebV client, is in shared content store mode by the little X's that are on top of the icons. These are sparse files that we're used to from Linux operating system. So the actual app file doesn't live here, but it's a pointer to the network. But it doesn't matter. I mean, I can still launch applications like I showed you before. So this one, you know, it just runs because everything is redirected to the network. So there's nothing much I can show you there. What I do can show you is that same as in the slide deck, where I can say, well, normally my cache would have been, in this case, 212 megabytes, but now I only have 2 megabytes of files. So nothing actually lives on this client. It's all redirected to the network. All right. Let me walk you through the design process that we did at this particular customer. So this customer environment, it was a government company. They had about 4,000 centrally managed desktops, laptops, Windows XP still in place, roaming profiles, and they had two primary sites, but it was within the same city. So there were no, you know, geographically boundaries or those kind of hard things. So their design goals for the new environment was to improve flexibility because there were, you know, fixed desk seating. So they want to improve flexibility, support a diversity in end-user devices, and you know, stimulate a new way of working. People could sit anywhere, work from home, those kind of things. So the end result was that they, you know, heavy betted on hosted virtual desktops, VDI. And their case was, I think, around 70-80% on non-persistent VDI or pooled VDI. And there are some persistent VDIs in there as well. But the majority is non-persistent, which means that the application have to be delivered in that environment, you know, quickly after logon because they're not in the base image. So why did this customer go for FV5? So I joined the program when they were in the decision point whether to go to 4.6 or to go to 5. And FV5 was still in beta then. Well, one of the biggest drivers for them was they had this, you know, expensive Fusion I/O storage cards that, you know, can create like 1 zillion IOPS. But the storage is very small. I mean, it's like 750 gigs on a specific card. So the less storage they, you know, could have on that machine, the better. So that was actually their killing feature. But also, if you look at it, if they went for 4.6 at that point in time, they would have a migration path in the near future because FV5 was, you know, about to get out. I think it was 4 months later it got out. So they just went for adopting the latest and greatest. So this is what their architecture looked like. I was not part of the decision flow on any of the other components, but it was a quite interesting stack because, for example, Novell ZenWorks Configuration Manager was used to deliver, you know, physical applications to the machine, but obviously that doesn't have any integration with FV5. And there's also some absence, a User Environment Manager used for personalizing applications and personalizing the user profile. So it was very interesting to see how those solutions would handle FV in a way. But since there was no delivery in place for FV, we decided to go for the full infrastructure because that's the, you know, the lowest impact on in this this particular environment. So if you look at the AppV infrastructure, it has changed a little bit, but the components are still there. Some of the stuff has moved, so the management server has no longer any reporting role. That's offloaded to the reporting server. And there's a publishing server now between the client and the management server, so the client doesn't directly connect to the management server anymore, which is, I think, pretty good for scalability scenarios. So if you look at the data flow, it's the packets data flows from the sequencer to some kind of packets repository to the streaming server to the client. And the management data flows, you know, from the database to the management server, publishing server, also down to the client. So those are the two flows. They differentiate in size. I mean, one of them is XML files, so that's kilobytes, and the other is, you know, plain old package data, so that's gigabytes and the megabytes, the gigabytes. So the package data, you know, every time the application is launched, given this is a shared content store scenario, every time the content will flow down from the streaming server, every time. So there's a high network dependency for the streaming because no streaming server means no applications because they are not cached in any way. And the package data is most likely to grow when the number of applications and the number of users will grow. So we had the idea already pretty soon that the streaming server was going to be an important component that we had to be able to scale out quite easily. I will come back to that a little bit later. So then we look at package load states, and that's important because we were using a shared content store scenario, so we had to be aware of the fact that, so where does this package reside? How dependent are we on the network? And this hasn't changed that much, but there is a small change that is easy to overlook in the sequencer because the default behavior of the sequencer is different at the box where you can optimize the application packets for streaming. And a new option that is in there is called fault streaming. So in the 4.6 sequencer, the default behavior would be that everything would be put into, I think it was called feature block 2, or at least the part that will stream down to the client up to, you know, when the application is fully cached. Now the default behavior is fault streaming. And if you want to be able to run the application offline and you haven't configured autoload, because obviously that also has to do with it, the default behavior is that the application will go to fault streaming by default. So there are some changes in here as well. But the biggest important thing for us was the fact that there's now a certain set of information that is cached on the machine. That's that 5% icons, you know, some libraries, some meta information about the package, and the rest is streamed on demand. So if you look at service disruption impact, we did a analysis of what was the user experience when, you know, specific servers would fail. And we decided to put the management server and the database kind of in the same category, medium to low, because if the management server is down, the client doesn't talk to the management server anymore. That only means that I cannot add a package anymore. Well, I mean, depending on the organization, if you have time to rebuild that infrastructure, that's no problem. But that kind of depends on your scenario. However, if the publishing server and the streaming server are down, then we had no applications at all. So that has a very high impact. The reporting server we didn't use because there was another reporting solution in place. But that, I would argue that one is also low because reporting data is cached on the client anyway if it cannot connect. So we came up with this high-level design, and it's not the only design that you could think of, but let me walk you through some of the components that we built. First of all, the database. We had a cluster database, which is, I think, at the moment the only supported solution for high availability in AppV. But the service was already in place, so we basically hosted the database there. We had some calculation maps from Microsoft, how to, you know, estimate the size of the database, and implemented some standard, you know, backup and restore procedures. Nothing hard there. I mean, you have to do some scripting, but it's to create the databases. But other than that, it's fairly easy. We decided to create two management servers, one at each site, because of the fact that if it was down, we still had the other one. So if it was down for a long time, maybe we could point the publishing servers to the management server. But they're not, you know, they're not heavily questioned all the time by publishing servers. There's just this polling interval of a default of 10 minutes, and there's some XML data flowing there, so it's not very hard. And because there's no actual data on the machine, we decided not to back them up as well. Just, you know, if we wanted to revert, just roll out a new machine, point it to the database, and you're up and running in no time. But that's a decision that we made. You may argue with that. The publishing servers, we decided to combine the streaming role with the publishing role. And that's not mandatory, but we thought it was a good idea because we wanted to do HTTP streaming. So both HTTP and SMB are supported. RTSP is no longer supported. How many of you have RTSP streaming? Some of you. Okay, in FP5, that's no longer supported. So it's either HTTP or SMB. Publishing server already requires HTTP. It requires IIS. And because we decided to put the publishing and the streaming dependency in the same category high, we said, well, just put them together so we can easily scale out that solution. So it's a one-stop shop for both the publishing information and the streaming information for those clients. And content replication is not handled by AppV. So you either use DFSR, which we did, or you use plain old like RoboCopy or whatever solution you have in place. But it's not handled by AppV, so you have to implement it yourself. The load balancer, I remember in AppV, there was some AppV4, there were some challenges. You wanted to do RTSP through load balancing. In AppV5, if you use standard HTTP, it works like a charm. So we decided there was already a Cisco ACE in place. One at each site. It was one virtual environment. We created this active-passive context. So the clients on one hand had the active context on that same site and a backup on the other side. And we could easily check availability of the server and the service through HTTP ports. And depending on the ports that you use, if you use streaming port 80, that's easy to check. It's also usually open in firewall, so that makes it a lot easier as well. Publishing port is, whatever you want. But if you put them on the same machine, it cannot be the same port, right? So you have to choose another one. I chose 81, or you could use any port you'd like. If they're on two different machines, you still could use port 80. And one thing that we decided to implement as well, something called stickiness, which is a really load balancer kind of terminology, or I think it's called device affinity, how Microsoft calls it in their load balancing solutions. We set it, so it basically determines if a session within a specific time has to be redirected to the same server or that is, it's divided for each and every request. And we just divide it because then it scales out more easily. So we didn't use a reporting solution, we didn't use the reporting server because it's handled by another solution. All servers are virtualized and we used the shared content store for VDI. And actually, the implementation is very, I mean, if you're familiar with the AppV4 infrastructure, this is just as hard or easy, however you want to call it. It's basically some IIS components that you need to set up and implement. So there were no challenges in setting up this infrastructure at all. So let me walk you through in the last 40 minutes through some of the experiences that we ran into. I think that's the most interesting part for you guys. If you look at sequencing, how many of you are doing, sequencing on a day-to-day basis? Or are you more like admins? Does anybody do any sequencing? Some of you? Okay. So the sequencing flow is pretty much the same. It hasn't changed really. Obviously, the sequencer is new. There are some small things. The shortcuts and file types are no longer part of the wizard. They're in the editor in the end. And some of the tabs have merged, or not really merged. I think they dropped just one tab that actually showed that date time info, like I said on the slide. But other than that, the sequencer is fairly easy. There's no real change there. The converter, if you have a AppV4 infrastructure and you have AppV4 packages, you have to convert them to be able to run them on an AppV5 client. They're not exchangeable. And it only works from 4 to 5, so you cannot, go down. You can have the same client, the both clients on the same machine, as I also showed you on the demo machine. And there are some migration paths in there as well. But the APV4 packages cannot, you know, natively land on an APV5 client. There's a conversion process in place. As I told you, this customer was new to APV technology, but they were already sequencing. So they had a lot of applications already in the project based on APV. So we did run into some conversion challenges. And one of the things that we noticed is that because the package model has changed a bit, that may require additional work. And one of the things that we noticed is that, for example, if you do scripting in OSD files, like some of you guys are doing right now, an OSD file is per application. But the new configuration XMLs are per package. And we had applications where we had a single package with four applications with four different configurations. And that's not possible, because that's no longer on application base. So you can create a package with four different configurations, but not on the same machine. So there are some small changes there. So you have to be careful if how big of an impact that is to you. So walking through the APV package converter, the slide is longer, so don't take any pictures just yet. By the way, the slides will be up, I think, within 24 hours. So you can download the PowerPoint then as well. These are some of the things that we ran into. So the package converter only will convert the packages that are APV4.5 and higher. Well, OK, that's pretty fair. But they will also convert if you have a Win7 tag in there or higher. Now, I have always, used the best practice not to use any of the OS tags inside the package. How many of you have OS tags in their packages? Some? Okay. If you don't have a Win7 tag in there, the converter will not even run. It will not even convert the package. This is easily scriptable to put into the XML file, so the impact is medium. If you have any scripts in your original OSD file, they will not be migrated. You can implement scripts in APV5, but you have to do that manually. So the functionality is still there, but it's not converted. The registry tag in the OSD file is not converted. There's a registry tag in there, as I showed you in the demo, but it's not converted. And the same goes for dynamic suite composition. But dynamic suite composition, that's fair, because the dynamic suite composition is no longer handled in the package, right? It's in the infrastructure. So it's fair that there's no way to migrate that, because it's not on the APV5 package anymore. So these functionalities are not migrated, but the good thing is the converter process will actually report that for you. So it will tell you that it found these items inside your package and that you may have to do something. Now, the next ones are a little bit more tricky. If you have any feature blocks in your package, which you most likely have, they are not migrated. If you have any terminate children settings in your package, they are not migrated. And if you have any empty directories, this usually involved some, if the sequencer by default didn't capture a specific directory and you wanted to override that directory in the package over a local directory, it was sometimes useful to add stuff to your virtual environment so that you set it to override and it wasn't dependent on the underlying operating system. So if you did plain old sequencing, you probably don't have any empty directories, but if you did some customizations there, you might have them, and they're not migrated. So they're left in the APV4 package. So feature blocks, I would say, has a low impact because, that will only maybe impact the time it takes to load and launch the applications. The other two are medium impact because it's very likely that the application will fail or have at least a different user experience. The downside is the converter won't report you on this one. So it doesn't do it, and it won't report you. So that's pretty bad. The third category is somewhere in the middle, I would say. It kind of depends. It's not everybody uses this, but we ran into some weird situations. So as I told you, the APV has these new extension points that it can register on the operating system to use a more advanced integration with the operating system. These extension points are not migrated from APV4 to 5. So you could say, well, they're not available on 4. Well, technically they are, because they are somewhere in the registry of that package, if you haven't cleaned up the package too much. Because if you migrate a package and you open and save it, then the new registry stuff, the new extension stuff gets exposed into the XML files. So it's possible, but it's not handled by default. But the experience won't be any worse because the extension points were not available in MP4 anyway. So I would say that's a low impact. So the last three are some of the stuff that's... So environment variables, we ran into applications. Environment variables actually do get migrated, and they do get tokenized to new directories. So if you had like SFTMNT or CSIDL, whatever variables, they do get migrated to the new tokens. But we saw that it wouldn't always work. And I have a screenshot of that in the next slide. The same goes for tokenized directories. Doesn't always work. You really have to test those out. And the last one is, I think, one of the toughest ones. That is, if you have sequence and application package on APP v4, and you would have a reference in there somewhere to Q, the old or whatever drive letter you were using, APP v would try to virtualize that directory and create that SFTMNT variable. However, it would only do that in this, you know, in the registry or the stuff that, you know, it's familiar with to look in. One thing it won't look in is inside, you know, text-based configuration files, .cfg, .ini, .whatever. A lot of applications still have configuration inside ini files, which means that there is a reference to Q. If you've sequenced to Q, which is the best practice, if you've sequenced to Q, it's most likely that there will be a reference in that file to Q. Since there's no longer a Q drive on APP v5, it's very likely that that application will fail. It's not handled by the sequencer. It's also not handled by the converter. So that's a very tricky one. That one probably requires resequencing. There is a fairly easy way to test that, and that is on your APP v4 client, change the drive letter from Q to R or S or whatever, and see if the application still works. Because if that will still work, then it doesn't have any references to that Q drive anywhere. So to give you an example of that environment variable, you see that the environment variable, actually, this is a screenshot of the environment variable inside the new APP v package. So you can see that it actually picked up the new tokens. So it did get converted. You could see that the file that this particular application needed was there as well, but the application couldn't start because it tells us that it couldn't find the file. So we resequence this application on MV5 and it works. So that's weird. The environment variable is there, the file is there, but still the application wouldn't work. And this is an example of that Q drive. So this is a application which has an msdir.cfg. And this was an MV4 package, so it was sequenced to Q with a specific 8.3 directory. And if you migrate this one, the APP v5 client will tell you, I don't know what Q whatever directory is. And this is a tricky one, if you have any of those. And it's very likely, the chance of you having any references to Q is pretty high if you follow best practices, right? So that's kind of hard to do. So let me show you that package converter process. I will go to my sequencer. So the converter is installed through the sequencer. The converter process, and let me see if I have any packages here. Let me delete those. So what I did, the command line is convert from package, and then destination path of source path, destination path, etc. But I created a simple script. It's on my blog to enumerate through a set of directories and just, you know, populate all the files from FV4 and parse them through to the conversion process. One of the cool things I did with PowerShell, or learned with PowerShell. So basically, it's going to convert, and it's going to report all the stuff into a log file. And obviously, I have manipulated these package files a little bit so that you can actually see some of the errors that it's doing. Four applications. Let me make this a little bit bigger for you. So I have a 7-zip package, and the package converter did not convert because the following registry key was there. which proves that registry keys are not migrated, but luckily they get reported by the sequencer or by the converter.
So this package has a OS tag. The package can detect one or more applications, has an OS tag for an operating system that is not supported, Windows XP in this case. So it won't even migrate that that package. If you look into the, which one was it? FileZilla. It didn't even migrate this one. But it does report you, so that's good. Chrome, Google Chrome, I had a script in Google Chrome, are not migrated, as you can see here. And the last one is a dynamic suite composition that also doesn't get migrated. But there's no way to migrate that anyway. So this shows you that the converter actually does, you know, provide you with the info. And you can run this in two modes. You can run it in info mode, where it won't actually convert it, but it will report you on the stuff. Or you can run it in actually conversion mode. When it's successful, it will actually convert the package. I mean, you can, you know, throw this to your package environment, and it's fairly easy to convert. However, you do have to test your applications afterwards, especially if you have errors like this. So the registry, you can implement again. The scripting part, you can implement again, but you have to do it by yourself. So some of the other stuff that we've run into. AppV has always been used to do some kind of a cross-platform, cross-architecture. So I was going to say Win Vista, Win 7, but it's probably Win 7, Win 8, or X64, X68. Sequence once, deploy many. That was the whole idea, right? Terminal server, whatever. That's still possible, and that's still very powerful. But there's a slight caveat that we ran into, and that is, if I have a 32-bit application, I can sequence that application on a 32-bit sequencer or on a 64-bit sequencer. Works in the same way. Obviously, a 64-bit application, I can only sequence on a 64-bit sequencer. But what is new, and it wasn't the case in MV4, if you've sequenced a 32-bit application on a 64-bit platform, a tag gets added into the package where it says sequencing station processor architecture equals X64. And this means that if I add this package to a 32-bit client, it won't work. It won't even add it. So I always have been a fan of using the same processor architecture as the application, so sequencing 32-bit on a 32-bit machine. And this proves that that's still the case if you want to do any cross-platform architecture. And there was one thing we ran into, is that the new FV5 extension files, they don't get extended for some reason, but I think that's a bug. I haven't checked in SP1 if that's fixed, because there's no reason why it wouldn't do that. In FV4, we were used to sequencing to Q and create this 8.3 asset directory. There's no more Q drive. There's now something called the Primary Virtual Application Directory, or PVAD, how they call it. It's still the same functionality, still the same idea. So in an FV4 package, you would have as much as possible an SFTMNT directory and as little as possible in the virtual file system, because there was this performance overhead. I always argue that, because I never seen that proven, and it's sometimes inevitable to sequence because some applications just install. But, you know, keeping that as a reference, so put as much as you can in SFTMNT and as little as you can in virtual file system. That still applies to FV5 packages. Put as much as you can in the primary virtual application directory and put as little as you can in the virtual file system. However, what is that primary virtual application directory? And that's an interesting discussion, because if you were to ask Microsoft, and I think it's even in their sequencing guide, they would say, well, if the application normally installs to C program files, Adobe Reader, then that would be your primary virtual application directory. Well, there are some quite interesting things that I ran into. The first one is, the primary virtual application directory question in the sequencer is asked before you actually install the application. So that's kind of weird. So in the flow, that's kind of, why would it ask me here? But if you're a good sequencer, you have tested your application, and you know where it's going to install, and you know, you create that directory. But the second is, the actual directory name is arbitrary, because it always will become converted to root. It will always be named root. So there's no link somewhere to C program files anymore. Even stronger, I think C program files is one of the worst directories you could choose, because that's a different directory between x68 and x64. So in the example that I just gave you with that reference to Q, if you have an application with an INI config file and you've sequenced to C program files, that application will not work on a 64-bit platform, because that directory is not tokenized by the sequencer, and it will, you know, point to the wrong program files directory, because that's the one directory that changes between those processor architectures. So my thought is, of all the directories that you can choose, please don't choose program files because of that dilemma. And the last one is, and that's also a tricky one, is that the primary virtual application directory doesn't get merged when you create connection groups. Now, this depends on how your applications are looking at each other. Because if they find their way through registry or anything, they will find their, you know, application in their files and those kind of things. But if it's any other way, so if it wants to browse down directly to the PVAT, the application just won't work. So these are some of the tricky things that we run into with the directory. Shared content store. I love this implementation. I think it's one of the most innovative things we've seen in FV5. It was a key selling point for my customer, at least, who is doing VDI. And if you guys or anything are looking into VDI, look into this solution as well for FV5. I actually added this slide after Tech at North America because I got a lot of questions on the tray icon. How many of you are disabling the tray icon in FV4? Okay, not that many. Okay, I think I got 10 people asking me this question. So it's not configurable anymore in FV5, not through the registry, not through group policy. However, it's also not critical anymore in the launching process, because the tray icon is just there as a user experience icon. So SFT tray was actually part of the launcher process. So it's not supported, and you didn't get it from me, but if you want to disable it, just rename all those, there are two, ux.exes to ux.old or whatever, reboot your machine, and the tray icon will be gone. There are two, the EPV client UX, that's the client management console, if you want to get rid of that, if you don't want to, you know, give that to your users. And the other one is actually the streaming icon in the bottom right. Packet source root is kind of the equivalent of the application source root in FV4. If you want to override your streaming URL, the behavior has changed a little bit. After you have applied a packet source root, there's no way you can add a package from another location, even if you manually add it. And that was not the case in FV4. There's still a way to overrule that packet source root. And in one of those config files, there's an opt-out option. You can change that, but you know the process would be really weird, because if I wanted to test that on a specific machine, I change the package configuration, test it, okay, change the package configuration back, and then put it into production. That's not very likely. So be careful with this packet source root behavior, and if you're implementing that. And if you apply it, it doesn't get applied to active sessions at once, which was the case in application source root. So it takes some time for session timeouts before it'll apply. All these configurations are done through group policy. You can actually see if a configuration is set by group policy, and the FV client will respect that in any way you can, even if you're an admin. So if you've run into that packet source root thing and you say, okay, just delete that setting, that's not possible if it's set by group policy. So be very careful with everything you set through group policy, because it's not going to be changeable on the client. And this was another thing I added compared to Tech at North America, because I got questions on this as well, and it's around group policies. In FV4, it was very tricky. If you had an application and you had some group policy keys in there, to apply a group policy from outside the virtual environment on the operating system to get applied inside the application package. So, for example, Adobe Reader has a group policy template, and I can manage my Adobe Reader, you know, configuration with it. But if I've sequenced Adobe Reader and that key is part of that package, it will not, you know, it will not fall down to the operating system settings, but it will use its own virtualized settings. So you should always delete those keys. New in FV5 is what they call pass-through paths. So I didn't practice that word, as you can hear. And there are a couple of them in there. The list is even longer, but one of the two I wanted to point out here are the policy keys. So even if you've sequenced your application package with those policy keys, at runtime, the application, the AppV client will ignore those settings and will always fall back to the AppV or the native operating system, which is very good because now you can actually manage those applications from outside the virtual environment. So some of the server stuff, I think the split between the management server and the publishing server is pretty good. It really offloads the management server. It doesn't create that big a dependency. Setup is fairly easy. If you look at publishing performance, we ran into some issues here. And we're still debating with Microsoft what's causing this. The thing I want to give you is it's no longer linear. That's the biggest thing. So in Appv4, it was, more applications. It takes longer to process. But now it depends on a couple of things. So the answer I got from Microsoft is that it depends on the number of those extension points that are part of your package that it needs to apply at publishing time. That makes sense. If you have a lot of COM objects, for example, that may take time to process. I also see that larger packagers tend to take longer. I don't know exactly why. Microsoft says that has nothing to do with the packet size because you actually reach into the AppV file and directly get the good content. But just make sure you check the publishing performance before you go into production to see if it meets your requirements. One of the things that is pretty harsh is that during that publishing time, so let's say the publishing takes 30 seconds for a certain set of applications, each application published will cause a flicker of the start menu. So users that will go to the start menu right after they log on and go to maybe Outlook or Internet Explorer, one of the local applications, the start menu will drop in during that publishing performance. And one of the answers I got from Microsoft there is that go to Windows 8, because there you don't have a start menu anymore. So that's something you can do. We are doing some performance testing with the Login VSI. How many of you are familiar with Login VSI? So Login VSI is a performance tool, and this is just a screenshot of some of the stuff that they are doing. They can simulate user workload, and it is very interesting to do this in this customer side because Microsoft doesn't have any metrics yet on how to scale out an AppV infrastructure. So what we are doing, we are building this workload for users, and we are logging on 150 users at one or in batches. And see what the stress is on the VDI environment, as well as on the AppV server, for example, from a streaming perspective. If you want information about Login VSI, come up to the booth, and I can give me your name and your email. I can hook you up with a license if you want. And I wanted to also show you that I. As well as three other MVPs, I'm writing an AppV book. It's free. Hurry! And it's released on a chapter base. We are currently at chapter one, so we're not very far. But I know chapter two is very close to releasing. I can give you that. So either go to www.appvbook.com, give us an email when you can hook you up with a free copy, or come up to the booth as well, with a name and an email address. And I can help you with that. So some of the key takeaways before you walk out of there. I think Appv5, if you're undecisive on what to use, Appv5 is a very solid, future-ready release. I really love the new functionality that is in there, and I think it will grow even stronger. And one of the reasons I think that is that because Office is delivered with the same technology. How many of you have bought a Service Pro or ordered a Service Pro? Nah, more than that. Not everybody. There were huge queues in the U.S. for the Service Pro. So if you use the Service Pro, you could see that there's a click-to-run Office in there, and it will actually stream down the bits through the technology that is provided by AppV. So, which is why I think AppV5 will be a very strong and solid release. It has a rich feature set, but... there are also some things that are dropped. And if you're, some things are at new locations and some things are, not available anymore. For example, the tray icon. So it may take a while for you to figure out, what's new and what has changed. But I think the impact is primarily in the package, conversion and migration process. That's where the impact is. If you're a new customer, you won't, get into issues there. So if you're new, definitely take five. With that, I still have room for questions. I want to thank you for your attention.